This is The Guardian.
Hi, Laura Murphy Oates here. Before we kick off Full Story for 2022, we're revisiting our favourite episodes from the past year. Today, in an episode that originally aired in August last year, we explore how one moment in history, known as the Tampa Affair, changed the way that we treat asylum seekers and refugees coming to Australia. I personally was a kid during the Tampa Affair, so this episode was not only a whirlwind journey through history, but it also brings together two incredible voices and storytellers, Guardian journalist David Marr and Afghan refugee Abbas Nazari. Okay, here it is.
When the Tampa first sailed into Australian waters after rescuing more than 400 Muslim asylum seekers, no one could have predicted the dramatic sea change ahead.
In 2001, when a Norwegian freighter called the MV Tampa rescued hundreds of mostly Afghan asylum seekers from a sinking boat, this sparked a crisis now referred to as the Tampa Affair.
They sent the SAS out to take possession of a boat full of demoralised, some of them sick, refugees, a boat belonging to a friendly European nation.
This moment and the response by the Howard government would shape Australian border policies and how those who arrive on our shores by boat are treated in Australia for the next 20 years. Today, the dark legacy of the Tampa Affair. It's Thursday, the 26th of August.
My name is Abbas Nazari. I am 27 years old. I am an Afghan refugee. I am a New Zealander and happy to be speaking with everyone today.
Where are you speaking to me from today? Not just physically where you're sitting, but you can tell us about that as well.
I'm currently in my hometown of Christchurch, New Zealand. I've just returned back from 2 years abroad in Washington, D.C., where I was studying my master's degree at Georgetown University. Happy to be back. Happy to be back in the South Island of New Zealand. This is home for me.
Can you tell me about growing up in Afghanistan? Where did you grow up and what was life like there?
For the first 7 years of my life, life consisted of running around beautiful village of Sungjoy in the province of Ghazni in Afghanistan. Our village is located at about 2,000 metres above sea level in a valley high up in the mountains, the Hindu Kush Mountains. Life for us, those first few years, was idyllic. Our village is small and beautiful, and it was harsh. It was man versus the elements. But, you know, for the large part, we lived a very organic village lifestyle.
Can you tell me about your family?
In my family, it's obviously mum and dad, myself. I've got five brothers and an older sister. So mum and dad and seven kids, you know, a clan of nine, and that makes the Nazari family.
And why did your family flee your hometown? Do you remember what was going on at that time?
I was born in the mid-90s, around the same time when the Taliban overran the country. And we thought we could wait it out. There were many opportunities to flee before we did. But we thought perhaps no, you know, there will be peace. But by 2001, when the Taliban controlled close to 90% of the country, when the violence was starting to creep closer and closer to our village, that's when we knew we had to leave.
Tell me about that journey, fleeing Afghanistan.
We were in a small refugee camp on the outskirts of Quetta, Pakistan, for a couple of months when we decided where to go from here. Do we stay and wait it out and try and get back to Afghanistan maybe when the war is over? Do we register with the UNHCR and hope for resettlement elsewhere through those channels? There is no queue, there is no system. And so when you are forced with the decision that my dad had in front of him, which was to stay in a refugee camp with his children, endless years, who knows, it could be 1 year, could be two, could be 20, or... You know, do we go for the slim opportunity that some of us had heard about, and that was try and get yourself to Indonesia and then get in touch with some people who could ferry you across the Indian Ocean to the Australian mainland. You know, a lot of people ask me, Abbas, what do you remember about that journey? And one of the visions that still stick with me to this day in ultra high definition is being awakened at the middle of the night and being ferried across Jakarta in the middle of the night in the back of these minivans and arriving at the seashore. And you can make out in the darkness, lapping amongst those waves, is a old wooden rickety fishing boat.
So this boat was named the Palapa. What does that word mean?
I think the Palapa is a Spanish word for a flimsy palm-leafed, shade. And, it had about the same level of structural integrity, I have to say. And as we're inspecting this thing, we see more and more van loads of desperate asylum seekers, you know, arriving by the minute. And you can tell that there are more people than this boat can carry. An argument ensues. People are incredibly angry that they've been duped and ripped off of their life savings. Mum was incredibly, incredibly apprehensive about getting on, you know, and he says to my dad, how can you put your children on that boat? And my dad on the other side says, what choice do I have? You know, we have made it this far from our village in Afghanistan, across the border to Pakistan, to Indonesia. And here we are on that final step. Where do you want to go from here? Do you stay? Or do you go into the unknown? So I remember that vividly, seeing that boat, climbing aboard and just being packed in like a box of dates. And we're packed into the hull of this ship, and after a few hours, it starts to get moving. My last image of land was, you know, just seeing the hills, the green hills of Jakarta start to go away in the distance, and the sun rises and we are out in the Indian Ocean. But at that very moment, the mood was buoyant. The mood was happy. The fact that people thought, look, we could, you know, it's only 2 days. We can do this. And we are on our way. This is our final step to security and salvation.
So, David, in 2001, while Abbas is on the boat, the Palapa, what were you doing back in Australia?
I was at the Sydney Morning Herald. I was working there as general journalist, writing about politics and preparing for the election.
David Marr is a journalist, a Guardian Australia.
John Howard was facing an election before the end of the year, and so we were all sort of beginning to gear up on political stories. And I'd written about the refugee situation, and I'd written about the boats. So this was a subject that had very much crossed my desk.
And what was the conversation like in the community about asylum seekers arriving by boat?
Far more people arrive undocumented and unexpected seeking asylum by air than they do by boat, but it's the boats that spark the fears. So something like half the electorate was worried about the numbers that were coming. The numbers were growing. They weren't huge, though. I mean, they were perfectly manageable numbers, but they were growing. And this was being beaten up by the Howard government in particular, but the Labor Party was doing absolutely nothing to calm these fears.
I think I've seen polling and reports at the time that this was an issue that voters cared about, but not really a big issue before Howard started talking about it. Is that right?
That's correct. But you have got to dismantle the Australian electorate to understand why these votes mattered a great deal. These were the votes of the most fearful Australians. And those voters are crucial to the election of Conservative governments. If you can't hold on to them, you can't rule as a Conservative government. That is why educated, quite liberal, quite progressive in a way, Conservative governments in this country are always, on issues like this, really primitive. And that primitive politics is about securing the vote of that electorate.
When did trouble first begin on the journey?
We made it for the first 15 hours without trouble. And then after that, you know, the engine starts sputtering and really, really desperately trying to keep going. So it's almost like a donkey that's been whipped to death. And after 24 hours, the boat was dead in the water. We had no propulsion. The engine had shorn off completely off its base, off its mount. And we had no radio contact for fear of being picked up by the authorities. So within 24 hours, our boat, the Palapa, was dead in the water. Once we knew that it was beyond repair, we started looking for avenues for rescue. And two things happened that afternoon. One, there was a giant container ship far out in the distance that we were trying to get the attention of that never turned to rescue us or never saw us. And it saved itself a hell of a lot of trouble, I bet. And later on that evening, in the darkness, we heard the propellers of a plane. But because it was so dark, nobody saw it, but we knew that it was up there.
Christmas Island was, it is, a Coast Watch base, and planes would go out just surveying the sea, seeing what was there. And this plane saw the Palapa wallowing in the sea. It had clearly lost power. There were people attempting to row the Palapa with deck boards. And as the plane came around to look at the boat again, there were people on the roof jumping up and down and waving their arms. Normally, at that point, rescue would be put in train. But the Australians didn't. They tried to get the Indonesian Rescue Service to come and do the job. This is a gross breach of the understandings of the sea. It doesn't matter who is in trouble. Your most mortal enemy, you are supposed to go to their aid. But still, Australia didn't.
On the third night, a storm hit. What do you remember of that night?
That is the memory of my journey that is perhaps sharpest. Because it is so traumatic. Throughout this point, our journey had essentially, for me, was just a giant adventure with no real understanding of why we were going or where we were going. But it was at that very point during the storm that I kind of realized the gravity of our situation. Here we were, packed in this tiny fishing boat in the middle of the Indian Ocean, and we are being thrown around by the waves. Before me, I see the beams starting to splinter. I see holes appearing in the side of the ship. Water is coming in from all directions. People are screaming. People are being thrown around. I myself, you know, being a little kid, was sliding around on the deck, and it was just horrendous. You know, I remember my dad unbuckling his belt and then looping it around one of the rafters as almost like a handhold, and him gripping onto me so I wouldn't slide around.
How did you, as a 7-year-old at the time, process that? Were you aware that this could be the end?
You know, throughout the entire journey, you know, my dad is an incredibly stoic and brave man. You know, he's confident, doesn't show fear. But that was when I first saw him crumble and realized that in making that decision to reach safety and salvation for his family, that he had essentially rolled the dice, and here we were about to all die. And when I saw the fear and desperation in his face, that's when I realized that this was it. You know, how do you explain death to a 7-year-old? I guess when we were surrounded by it, you don't need explaining. I understood that this was it.
That it survived the storm that night is a miracle. It is a miracle. Whenever I hear an Australian politician say that whatever they do, however brutal it seems these days, at least people aren't dying at sea, I think of that night. What they did to the Palapa, how they left it out there for their political purposes.
The sun rose the next morning, the sea abated a little bit, and we were able to inspect some of the damage. And nobody reported that people were missing. There were so many injuries, ranging from small cuts and bruises to broken limbs. But by and large, nobody had died that night. The ship is in tatters, you know, beams are split, you know, railings are gone, you know, people are trying to put tarpaulins over some of the holes on the side of the boat, just trying to do anything they can. People are bucketing out water. Some people tried to, you know, fashion a pump from some of the old parts. Everyone was trying to do their bit. And it's at that point people start to talk about, you know, where to from here? What do we do? How do we call for attention? Because we are surrounded by the ocean. There is no land in sight. And then it was at that point that someone on board had this incredible idea that saved our life. And people, you know, some of the women donated their headscarves and we fashioned old bits of fabric or tarpaulin, whatever we could find. And someone used engine oil to write the letters SOS and help. And we laid this out on the top of the boat, hoping that if the plane comes again, that it would see us.
When the plane reappeared, they held up this sign saying help. At this point, it was absolutely impossible for the Australian government to continue to pretend that they did not know whether this boat needed to be rescued. I mean, it was a gross pretense, of course, because they were trying to get the Indonesians to do it. They knew the boat needed to be rescued.
You know, once that turboprop disappeared again for the second time after seeing our message, we had no idea what would happen next. But everyone stayed up top on the deck, waiting and looking out into the horizon for some sign of rescue. By now, it was a late afternoon, and at some point someone said, "Look out, what's that?" And we look out into the horizon, and everyone sees this small dot just kind of piercing that line where the sky meets the sea. And it's kind of gently coming towards us and getting closer and closer and closer to the point that we can make out this giant container ship, you know, with a giant piercing red hull and containers stacked on top. And it is heading straight towards us. It's coming with such speed that we don't quite know if it's seen us, actually. But it does an arc and it pulls up right next to us to the point where you can almost reach out and touch it. You know, it blocks out the entire horizon. And it was the MV Tampa, a 260-meter long Norwegian container ship that had answered the call to rescue and charted its way towards us and found us in those coordinates.
We did not know it was solely before it was coming more or less alongside the ship, because there was a fast-moving boat. And then it was too late to take in the pilot ladder again. So we just accepted them coming on board, yes.
The Wilhelmsen Line is a Norwegian shipping line which has been a really big little player in Australian trade for over a century. So when it was asked by the Australians to go and pick up the people from this wallowing fishing boat, it did.
Into the area where the refugees or survivors stayed. They came in this way. We had some containers further off there.
Two sailors came down the ladder and told us everyone climb up hand, foot, one by one. And that's exactly what we did.
We didn't let them bring any of their personal belongings on board to the Tampa, partly because this would slow the rescue operation if everyone was going to bring their bags and suitcases and plastic bags and whatever. So actually every one of the survivors were searched, a full body search when they came on board prior to counting.
From afar, we must have looked like ants climbing up the leg of a giant elephant, because this thing went on into the sky forever. And as we get to the top, another crew member puts a number on our wrist just to kind of keep track of how many people they'd rescued. And I think they'd prepared for something like 200. So the last number, 438, that's when we realized how many people were on board. And it was incredible that they had packed that many people into this small fishing boat.
What happened to the palapa?
You know, we were told not to carry any of our belongings. And so we all got up to the top of the Tampa. And as the last person, literally as the last person climbed aboard, that palapa, which was already breaking up, you know, sank. And it took with it all our belongings and it broke up into pieces. And all that was left of it was just bits of debris that was sliding around in the water. And right now, everything that people had bought, their luggage, their, you know, their whatever they'd bought from their villages back in Afghanistan, that is now at the bottom of the Indian Ocean.
Well, we apparently got more and more sick people down on the deck. You had 10 unconscious people down there in the end,
yeah,
more or less.
Tell me about the captain of the Tampa.
Arne Rinnan is one of those rare people in the modern commercial navy who had risen from deckhand to master of a boat, a man of great intelligence, good judgment, and decent principle.
What were the legal obligations of the Tampa and Arne Rinnan to these 400 rescued passengers?
There is a difficulty in international law here. There is an understanding that when a ship rescues people at sea, which is an unavoidable obligation of the sea, that they have a right to offload those people at the nearest port. Now, that is the convention of the sea, but it is not actually treaty law. There's a gap there. But Rinnan believed that he had a right to offload at the nearest port, except that the Australians asked him not to. They said, look, will you take those people, thank you for rescuing them, will you take them now to the Indonesian port of Merak, where we have, it's on your route, it's where you're going, and we have got permission from the Indonesians for you to land those people there. And so he set off for Merak.
At this point, a delegation from us, about five English speakers within our group, go up to meet with the captain to say, please, you know, we are asylum seekers. Please drop us off at Christmas Island. Given the language difficulties between our delegation and given the trauma of the night before and given the fact that we just changed course, it led to a pretty tense atmosphere, and I don't want to downplay that.
They was behaving in a very aggravated, highly excited manner, and they was talking about they will go crazy.
Some people made threats to say that if we don't go to Christmas Island, that I'll jump overboard.
They will jump the ship if you do not head it for Christmas Island.
Rinnan decided that he would do what he believed he was always able to do.
To turn around the ship for the safety of everybody on board to go to Christmas Island, which was also the closest port.
So he turned the boat around and he told everybody that by midnight, they would see the lights of Christmas Island, and everybody settled down.
Of course it was going to be tense. But Arne Rinnan himself, the captain, had said that he never felt that he was being threatened. He was definitely emotionally charged, but he never felt threatened, and he never felt like he had lost control of his vessel in any way.
We have subsequently been advised by the ship's captain that the reason he decided to enter Australian territorial waters was that a spokesman for the survivors of the Indonesian vessel had indicated that they would begin jumping overboard if medical assistance was not provided quickly, Mr. Speaker. And I table a telefax message from the Australian...
This line about Rinnan was only doing what he was doing because he was threatened was an important part of the political debate over the next few days, that Rinnan had lost control of his ship, and therefore this was no longer a refugee operation, it was a hijack. This was really nasty bullshit. When the Australian government started to threaten him and threaten the shipping line with fines and even the suggestion of imprisonment if they continued towards Christmas Island. So, in consultation with the shipping line headquarters back in Oslo, he decided he would turn around again.
Right, the captain actually turned around the boat two more times under pressure from the people on the boat and the Australian government, but eventually headed towards Christmas Island. What happened when they arrived?
As they got close to Australian territorial waters, the harbour master on Christmas Island radioed the ship and requested that they stand off until daylight, that they not enter territorial waters, and that arrangements would be made in the morning for the reception of the refugees. Rinnan always regretted decently obeying that request.
Mr. Speaker, the government has requested the Tampa not enter Australian territorial waters and that it should continue on its original route to Indonesia.
Because over the next few days, so much of the argy-bargy, the argument, the extraordinary events.
The motor vessel Tampa, in defiance of a clear communication from the Australian government, entered Australian territorial waters.
Were about entering Australian territorial waters. He wished that he'd just sailed in that night.
This was in contravention of clear advice from the Australian government to the Norwegian government, and also very clear advice to the master of the motor vessel Tampa that Australia was refusing the right of entry of the vessel into Australian waters.
What was it like at that time? There were several days where people were kind of stuck on the ship. What were conditions like on board?
Moored off Christmas Island, we could see the island. We could see some of the buildings. We could make out the airstrip. We could make out the cove, the port, all the rest of it. Conditions on board. Keep in mind, this is a container ship. It is not built for people. We were sleeping in empty containers. They had opened up another few containers on the other side. There were our latrines, you know, essentially bathrooms where we used buckets and plastic bags. And the space between the containers were what I call the town square, where everybody met and just sat down under the tropical sun. Someone fashioned a sunshade using tarpaulin because it was baking hot. I remember that very clearly. By and large, you know, we were seasick, dehydrated, but the most severe medical conditions were definitely regarding a few people. There were some people who were unconscious, who were fading in and out. Keep in mind, among our group, there were two pregnant women, and we didn't know the conditions of their babies, and there was no medical doctor on board. I remember the crew of the Tampa running around with IV drips, with first aid kits, doing their absolute best that they could.
Well, the Australian government told me a lot of things. That they will supply medical assistance, but nothing showed up.
Renan was asking for medical help. There was a hospital on Christmas Island. Medical help could have been got to him within hours. There were people sick on the boat. They needed help.
And the situation on board was getting worse and worse.
Under these circumstances, the law of the sea allows a ship to enter port by declaring a mayday. He declared a mayday, an emergency. He started his engines and he headed into port.
And that's when we were boarded by an elite SAS unit. And I remember that very distinctly. You know, these guys, I think there were about 40 or 50 of them. They came up in the rigid inflatable boats and climbed up the ladder, and we were surrounded, essentially. Everything, they were all wearing their military combat fatigues, you know, black helmets and visors and boots and some pretty big guns as well. And we had no idea what was happening and where did this order come from? And suddenly we were surrounded and we felt incredibly, incredibly fearful of what would happen to us.
Board and secure the vessel. My advice is that units of the Special Air Service under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Gus Gilmore executed this instruction over an hour ago, and the ship is now in the control of the SAS.
Part of the brilliant optics of the Tampa operation as played by the Howard government was to send out Australia's toughest soldiers, the SAS.
SAS personnel on the vessel have put it to the captain that the appropriate thing would be for the captain to return to international waters.
They sent the SAS out to take possession of a boat full of demoralised, some of them sick, refugees, a boat belonging to a friendly European nation.
That we stand ready and helicopters will be available, I understand, within an hour Eastern Standard Time.
It's just amazing.
Next, Prime Minister John Howard unveils a new plan, which to this day shapes the way Australia treats many asylum seekers. The day that the Tampa attempted to land at Christmas Island, Prime Minister John Howard introduced a bill to Parliament. Can you tell me about that?
You know, the Border Protection Bill, essentially a bill that would come into effect retrospectively to essentially deny us the right to asylum.
This was a bill which essentially allowed Australian officers to do whatever they liked out there without ever facing any consequences. But what it did most effectively was ruin the Labor Party.
Leave is granted. The Leader of the Opposition.
The Opposition will not support this bill. And the Opposition believes that it has been treated with a level of discourtesy.
Because Kim Beazley, the Leader of the Opposition at the time, had some decent objections to legislation of that kind.
What this bill means, and I think the Prime Minister got at it, was that no matter what the circumstances, it will be a reasonable and authoritative thing for an Australian officer to take a boat which is sinking, in which there are life-threatening situations involving the people on board, and order it out. That will be...
But when he attempted to raise them, the response from Labor Party voters was so brutal that he backed down. The Labor Party was completely wedged at this point and was useless as the crisis continued to unfurl. It was completely useless. Howard had dominated Canberra, dominated the political narrative completely.
You got some good news around this time that New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark had agreed to take up to 150 asylum seekers from the Tampa, primarily women, children and families. How were you told about this news?
It was probably our last day on the Tampa when we received that news. You know, once the SAS had boarded, we would receive a daily update from the commander. And one day we're told, we're going to be transferred to the HMAS Manora, which is an Australian Navy frigate that would come and pick us up so the Tampa could, you know, head on its way. Mm. And at the same piece of news, we're told New Zealand has accepted some of you. And for many of us, including my family, yeah, one of the first questions was, who was New Zealand? Because we had no idea this little country existed, no idea what it was like. Not many people could point it out on a map.
You thought it was a person.
Yeah, that's right. I remember distinctly someone asking, who is that? And it was one of the sailors pulled out a map of the world and pointed out where Australia was and where New Zealand was. And look, when they said that women and children and those in family units, you've been accepted to go to New Zealand, that was the point at which my life turned. We had no idea at that point what it meant for those who hadn't been resettled or who hadn't been accepted to New Zealand.
David, as we now know, many on the Tampa were sent to offshore detention on the Pacific Island nation of Nauru under a new policy that Howard called the Pacific Solution. He said at the time that offshore processing was about defending Australia's sovereignty against a rising number of asylum seekers who had come by boat, who he called unauthorised arrivals. And Philip Ruddock, the then immigration minister, also said that this would reduce incentives for people to make dangerous journeys to Australia. Does that tell the whole picture?
What in fact it was essentially to set up a prison on Nauru, right on the equator, and there imprison everybody from the Tampa and also some other boats which were coming in at the time. It wasn't just Tampa people that were going to be taken out there. And there they would be imprisoned by the Australian government as a lesson to the people smugglers.
More than 300 men from the Tampa ended up in detention on Nauru. Were you close to some of these men?
You know, having gone through what we went through from Pakistan to Jakarta to the Palapa to the Tampa to then the Manora, some of those men had been with our family for a few months at least. And so I knew them. You know, I called all of them my uncle. Some of them took care of me. And to see to see them being ferried from the Menorah to the island, and for us to not know what fate awaited for them, it was incredibly sad. I remember my dad expressly making a commitment to a couple of the men who they'd gotten close with, and he said, "Look, I'll do everything I can to try and get you to New Zealand." And some of them, sadly, ended up staying there for close to 3 years before they were finally offered resettlement in Australia and New Zealand and elsewhere.
The announcement of the Pacific Solution, how was that being perceived by the Australian public? And how did that reflect on John Howard at this time? Was it popular?
There was overwhelming support for Howard's policy. The fears of the nation had been very skillfully stoked. This seemed to be a solution to the problem of looming invasion by refugee. While there were strong voices raised in protest and some very good reporting of the brutalities that this involved, it was overwhelmingly popular.
This campaign, more than any other that I have been involved in, is very much about the future of the Australia we know and the Australia we love so much.
I was in the Sydney Recital Hall at the political meeting as the election got closer, where John Howard made the famous announcement.
But we will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come.
And I watched from an upper balcony a white middle-class crowd howl with satisfaction at this line. They howled. It was one of the ugliest sounds I've ever heard. It was a brilliant, absolutely brilliant line, because it was true. We do decide who comes to this country. My view, and I think it's the view of most people who were observing politics closely at that time, is that Howard would have won anyway. But this absolutely guaranteed it. It's what you do to guarantee the election.
There's been a lot of talk about how this moment was kind of a turning point in Australian policy for immigration, refugees, asylum seekers. I mean, do you see the imprint of this moment even more broadly in international policies? How do you see this legacy in its broadest sense?
With the Tampa, Australia gave other countries a precedent to follow, and they did. In particular, the brutality under Trump at the Mexican border, the brutality of the Italian government in the face of refugees, but with, frankly, it has to be said, a strong element of simply of immigration from North Africa. And as always, Australia inherited from Britain this notion that we can completely control who comes to our country. It's not a notion that European countries have, because they have common borders, but we are island countries. And that gives us this ambition to be able to control absolutely who comes to this country. But once a government says we can stop them coming, then you have to keep going with tougher and tougher measures. So the Howard government, succeeded by the Rudd-Gillard government. The Rudd-Gillard government very decently wound back a lot of the Howard government rhetoric and measures, but the boats did start to come and the politics of it shifted, and they resumed offshore processing. They reopened the great prison that the Howard government had built on Christmas Island. And then when Rudd came back to power in the months just before the 2013 election, he was the one who came up with this formula that anybody trying to get to Australia by boat will never live in Australia.
Offshore detention is, call it what you want, but for me, the way I see it, and knowing personally some of the people who have been through that system, it is a slow form of torture. I mean, think about this. They are held in open-air prisons in 40-degree heat year-round in the tropical Pacific, and with no end to that sentence. You know, if you're in prison, you know when you're going to get out, to the day, to the minute. And that is a torture in itself, not to mention the physical and mental toll that takes on people, that, you know, has led to self-harm and suicide in some instances. You know, I am forever optimistic that offshore detention will end sooner rather than later. And when that chapter is closed, when a commission of inquiry is conducted into that operation, I think that it will be a stain on Australia's reputation. And I think that Australians will look at themselves and say, you know, our taxpayer dollars funded that, and we voted for that, and it led to the deaths of dozens. And I hope we can learn from that. When that will happen, I'm not sure, but I hope sooner rather than later.
This week marks 20 years since this moment, and it strikes me that 20 years after the Australian government denied a boat of mostly Afghan refugees and asylum seekers entry to the country, we're now seeing this moment of crisis and need again for the Afghan people. What do you think of the government's response this time around?
It's almost like we've come back full circle. Sadly, all of the gains of the last 20 years looks like they'll be washed down the drain. The Taliban are trying to be modernised and moderate government, but their actions speak louder than words, and it looks like they're going to go back to the barbarism and the cruelty that they reigned with in the 90s. Look, if there's one thing I want Australians and Kiwis and listeners of this podcast to take, it's this. It's that when you see those people that are just begging to climb aboard one of those planes out of Kabul Airport, I hope that people have a semblance of understanding of the desperation that is driving those people out. Nobody wants to leave. Like I said, we lived a pretty basic but pretty peaceful life up in our villages. Nobody wants to leave and literally pack up everything that they've known in search of who knows where those planes will go.
There is the ability for people to make application through the Refugee and Humanitarian Program, and the Prime Minister's been clear about that again today.
When Peter Dutton the other night stood there and stared into the camera with those concerned eyes of his and said, "We must be very careful who we take from Afghanistan now that the Taliban has resumed control."
There are other family members. I give the example of the grandparents, but there are other circumstances where there are males of fighting age who are included in a family cohort, and we don't know enough about those individuals.
Because there might be terrorists among them.
And in the end, I can tell you, you and many other journalists would be screaming down the line at me if one person was brought in that committed an atrocity in our country. So we have to, you know, balance a lot of equities here.
It took me right back to 2001. That was 2001 again. It's the same appeal to the same fearful Australians for the same purpose, which is to get the loyalty of the cohort of Australian voters who are most fearful of race. And we will see if he succeeds, but I think he will. They do it. They do it, however embarrassing it is, for the rest of Australia and for Australia's reputation in the world, because it works. It wins votes. It's about votes.
Thanks to David Marr and Abbas Nazari for their time. Since this episode first aired, Abbas went on to give an address at the National Press Club of Australia on this topic. You can check it out in full online. You can also read his book called After the Tampa, From Afghanistan to New Zealand. I would also recommend Guardian journalist Ben Doherty's piece, The Tampa Affair 20 Years On, the ship that capsized Australia's refugee policy, at theguardian.com. We put some links to that on the full story page as well. This episode was produced by Ellen Lee Beta, Jane Lee, and Joe Koning, who also did the sound design. Additional production on our whole Best Of series was by Beth Atkinson-Quinton. The executive producers of Full Story are Miles Mattignoni, Gabrielle Jackson, and myself, Laura Murphy-Oates. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you tomorrow.